Miracles in My Life by J.N. Loughborough, Chapter 14, Called to England. As early as the spring of 1874, Elders James White began to talk to me about going to England. I hardly knew why he should ask me until I had been in California 5 years, and Elder Cornell explained. I heard Sister White say in one of her talks, "If Elder Loughborough is faithful, his labors will yet be called for in England." While I was staying with Elder White in the old water cure building on Lafayette Road, one Sabbath afternoon we walked up a mountain where we might have a prayer season. There among the chasmus brush, we both received clear impressions of duty. My wife's health indicated she was not long for this world. I owned a home in Santa Rosa, but she could not live there because of the occasional fogs. The Lord granted both Elder White and me a rich sense of His presence and light as to duty, that He should solicit money at the Eastern camp meetings for the signs of the times, and there also came before me a little glimpse into the future. As I arose from prayer, I said to Elder White, "It is all clear about your duty to go east, but the impression came to me as though an audible voice, 'Sell your place in Santa Rosa, but do not buy elsewhere. Your labors will be here and there, so you must not be fastened to one place.' I immediately put my house up for sale, and in 2 weeks' time received a draft for the sum I desired. From that time on, Elder White mentioned occasionally that the work should be opened in England, and hinted at my going. In the spring of 1878, he again went to Battle Creek, and from there wrote me to leave California and come to the General Conference to be held there in October, and they would vote that I go to England. I replied with 8 reasons why I did not think it advisable to make such a move just then. The most important were these. First, so many enterprises had begun in the work here that ought to be completed. And second, if I were to go to that field, I ought to have at least a year to study English customs so as to enter the field understandingly. 2 sentences of White's brief reply swept away my 8 reasons for not going that year. He said, "If you stay a year longer to complete what you say is begun, you will find more begun that needs to be finished than you see now. As for the study of English customs and adapting yourself to the work of England, the best place to study those things is right there on the ground where you see the customs for yourself." Still, it was not clear in my mind. Having spent 10 years in California and witnessed the rise of the work from the first, it was not easy to let go. After our return from the Oregon camp meeting in July 1878, I spent 2 busy days at Oakland shipping the tent and fixtures to Reno, Nevada, where I had agreed to hold a tent effort. On the 17th, I took the train for Reno. I showed my ticket to the conductor, then lay down for much-needed rest, and with a prayer for light about going to England. After an hour, I was awakened as if someone had shaken me, but there was no one near. Then the thought came vividly to my mind, "Put up your household goods for sale and make arrangements to go to England." Although this was contrary to reason, my mind was now at rest. I wrote to my companion, footnote, in 1875, Elder Loughborough married Anna Driscoll, Secretary-Treasurer of the Pacific Press. The ceremony was performed by Elder James White. Close footnote. I wrote to my companion in Oakland, telling her to leave the sale of our things to Providence, to put them up for sale, and if they sold, we would take this as evidence it was our duty to go to the General Conference. A day or so later, a brother who was soon to be married bought everything except our books and clothing. At Reno, with the help of Brother Ferguson, we erected our tent in a central place and opened up the meetings July 21st. Up to 500 curious people packed the tent nightly. Sister White, on her way east, stopped over at Reno and on July 30th gave an earnest message on the new birth from 1 John 3. Behold, what manner of love the Father hath bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God. Among the number who took their stand were two who received their first ideas of our faith at our very first tent meeting in Battle Creek in 1854. Footnote. Another convert at Reno was a young black man, Charles M. Kinney, who later attended Hillsborough College and became the first ordained black Seventh-day Adventist minister. End of footnote. After returning to Oakland August 21st, I spent 2 days shipping tents, books, etc. for our camp meeting at Yountville. We had only our conference workers to conduct this meeting, and there was good spiritual interest by our people. On September the 5th, we bade goodbye to our people in that part of the state and hurried to the Kings County camp meeting held near Lemoore. I went immediately to Oakland and shipped the tents and supplies to the campground. I arrived at Lemoore in time to preach at 11 a.m. Sabbath and then on the campground in the afternoon. As a result of almost constant labor and travel, I was so wearied that on the morning of September 11, after I had talked about 25 minutes, I fainted away in the pulpit. Elder Healy completed the sermon while the brethren carried me to my tent to recuperate. On Sabbath, 25 candidates were baptized in the irrigation canal not far from the camp. After returning to Oakland, we prepared for our Michigan trip, leaving September 19. At the General Conference, the advisability of extending the work to Great Britain was considered, and a vote was taken October 14 to send me to that field. After spending a few weeks in New York and Massachusetts, we left South Lancaster for Boston on December 10, 1878, expecting to sail for England on the Homer of the Warren Line. Mr. O'Hara, the agent, met us at the boat, stating that the captain refused to take on any passengers. But he continued, "If you consent, we will transfer you free of expense to the Nevada of the Williams and Goon Line, which will sail from New York tomorrow." In the providence of God, we found ourselves sailing for our English mission from a point about 40 yards from the pier from which I sailed June 24, 1868, to enter upon the California mission. Our trip to Liverpool took a little over 12 days. Some days the sea was very rough due to heavy storms, which had passed over a few hours before us. On Monday, December the 30th, we arrived safely at Southampton. The steamship Homer, on which we had expected to sail, was never heard from after leaving Boston Harbor. It is supposed that it capsized in a storm and went to the bottom of the sea. We soon found our way to the home of Henry Cavell. This godly family was very happy to see us, and in a few minutes, Elder William Ings came in from his missionary work. The next day, we rented a 5-room brick house, Stanley Cottage, for the winter, and arranged for Elder Ings to stay with us. I gave my first sermon in Shirley Hall the first Sunday evening after our arrival in England. Notwithstanding the fog and darkness that caused some to lose their way, we had an audience of 150 persons who gave marked attention to my message from Daniel 2. We gave a number of sermons here, and four individuals accepted the truth. When spring came, we purchased a 60-foot tent, erecting it in Southampton suburbs, and began meetings May 18. For $40, we purchased a harmonium with excellent tune and used it to add interest to the meetings. About this time, Miss Maud Sisley came from Switzerland and united with our company as Bible worker and coal porter. At the close of the meetings, 30 persons signed the covenant to keep all the commandments of God. On August 3rd, we began services in Ravenswood House, having just moved into that spacious building in which there was a large hall. 6 willing souls were immersed at our first baptism at Southampton, February 8, 1880. In June, we pitched the tent in Romsey, 8 miles from Southampton, and Elder Andrews came from Switzerland to assist as his health would permit. A few accepted the truth in this effort. By July 2, 1881, I had baptized 29 at Southampton. On the 9th of August, our hearts were made sad indeed by receiving a telegram from Battle Creek telling us of the death of our dear brother White, and that the funeral would be the next Sabbath, August 13. On the day of the funeral, I spoke from Revelation 14, verse 13. I told of Elder White's arduous labors in the past. From these the Lord called him to rest until the life-giver shall come. The first general conference after the death of Elder White was held at Battle Creek in December 1881. With only a short notice to prepare, I was requested to attend and to take back with me to England a force of workers who might be trained and return again to labor in America. The notice was so short that money could not be obtained from America to meet the needs of the work during my absence and to secure my ticket. We presented the problem to the Lord in prayer and pleaded for Him to open the way. As we sat at breakfast on the morning of the day that I must secure my ticket, the postman left 2 letters, one from a man in North England who wrote, "I do not usually pay my tithes until the end of the quarter, and this is only the middle. I have a check for over £8, $40. I am so powerfully impressed that you are in need of this now, that I send it to you at once." The other letter came from a Baptist brother who had just entertained me for 3 days in Manchester while I was attending meetings of the Vegetation Society and the British Anti-Narcotic League. He said, "I feel impressed that it is my duty to send you £5, $25, to aid in your work." Here was over $65 from an unexpected source. We recognized this as a direct answer to prayer. But there was yet another providence. When I negotiated for a ticket on the steamer Bristol of the Great Western Line, there was a delay in its arrival, and the ship Somerset was substituted. I went to their office to buy my ticket, but it seemed to be forbidden to do so. We prayed over it for another day. Then our minds were all turned to the steamer Rhein of the North German Lloyd Line, on which I embarked November 16. Although we made our passage during the terrible gales and ocean hurricanes of the last of November, encountering headwinds and storms all the way, and were 16 days making the voyage, unusually made in 11, there was no damage to our steamer, and I arrived in Battle Creek on the 3rd day of the conference. The Somerset was reported to have used up all her coal in mid-ocean 24 days later and drifted under sail to St. John's, Newfoundland, more than 1,000 miles from New York. Had I taken that boat, I would not have arrived until after the conference was over. On my return to England, I was accompanied by Elder and Mrs. A.A. John, George Drew, Miss Jeannie Thayer, and my son and daughter, all of whom entered the work in that field. On November 9, 1882, we left Southampton for appointments in North England. As we came into Newcastle, our train passed over the River Tyne, which was so far below us that tall masted sea-going vessels passed under the arches of the bridge. We visited the castle for which this place was named. It was first constructed of wood by Robert, the eldest son of William the Conqueror, in the years 1079 to 82. The present structure was built by stone by Henry II in the years 1172 to 77. It is said to be the most perfect specimen of a Norman castle existing in England. It is now used as a museum. Here are stone idols of our Saxon ancestors, also stone mortars, pestles, and battle axes. In the evening, we met in the Bible House where I spoke to the Newcastle Vegetarian Society, a large and attentive audience. On the 12th, we arrived at Hull, 21 miles upriver from Grimsby. It was from this point that our ancestors, the Loughboroughs of Leicestershire, set sail for America the latter part of the 18th century. Here I found my friend George Drew doing extensive missionary work on land and on board vessels visiting this port. We met difficulties in the establishment of our work in Great Britain that were not experienced in America. Those of wealth would not listen to the same man who spoke to the poor. We labored largely with merchants, tradesmen, and laborers. Ignorance prevailed among the poor laborers, the majority of whom were illiterate. Lords, nobles, and gentry seemed beyond our reach, even with coal porters, for their mansions were surrounded with high walls, with great iron gates locked and barred, and no admission unless you have a note of introduction from some of their own class. In our hope to find truth-loving persons among the wealthy, we saw no way to reach them except by sending them reading matter. Nevertheless, the Lord blessed, and our hearts were cheered to see some souls accepting the light despite perplexities. In the summer of 1879, when J. N. Andrews came to us from America, he was accompanied by his niece, Edith Andrews, and Annie Oyer, who were going to Basel, Switzerland, to help in the mission. Since our house was quite small, we arranged lodging for Edith and Annie at a near neighbor's place. Mr. Nippard, with whom Elder Inks had formed a slight acquaintance in his tract distribution work. Mr. Nippard and his family were friendly with our girls, and as Elder Inks studied the Bible with him, he really drank in the truth and expressed a desire to do all he could to help it along, although he did not see his way clear to keep the Sabbath. He was the ship keeper for the Pensular, an Oriental steamship company which sailed its steamers from Southampton to 80 seaports in the East and West Indies, Africa, and Central America. One day, Mr. Nippard told Elder Inks, "I can help you send literature to other ports. Just furnish me with rolls of papers directed to the agent of any port you wish. Enclose a letter asking him to hand them to any who might be interested. Thus, you can place your publications in ports all over the world. We heeded his advice. At that time, we were receiving 1,000 copies of the signs weekly from America. We would make a roll of signs, tracts, and papers in other languages, then enclose a letter asking them not only to circulate the tracts, but to inform us if other literature was desired. Although we received replies from South Africa, British Guiana, and other parts, not until 24 years later did we learn how a bundle of the signs was received at Cape Haitian, Haiti. The agent, not interested in religion, sent the papers to a Baptist minister who gave them to his church members. Among those who received them was a Jamaican named Henry Williams. After reading them, he and his wife began to keep the Sabbath. Though severely persecuted and at one time had to find safety in the mountains, they remained faithful. For 20 years, they kept the light burning alone. Then in 1904, they attracted the attention of a school principal who felt the third angel's message was an answer to his prayers. He wrote a tract telling why he had left Catholicism and joined the Adventists. His efforts were very successful and prepared the way for our mission work on the island. From January 1, 1879 to October 10, 1883, our workers in England visited 49,140 families and ships, distributed 84,887 papers, and sold nearly $3,000 worth of books. The number of those who embraced the truth was 100. After arranging the work in England to be managed by others, with my family I sailed from Liverpool for New York, October the 10th, 1883, on the steamship City of Rome.